Brow, where once again we're going to put big ideas through the digital martyrdom. Cranmer burning at the stake, big ideas undergoing the digital martyrdom. It's around Christmas time, and so we wanted to talk about what makes a Tory Christmas a Tory Christmas. The Tory Christmas party, for some reason, has the name the Dead Kitty Party. But if we told you why, we'd have to kill you, or you'd have to be part of the Institute. So we can't explain that Tory Christmas tradition. Mostly, Tory Christmas tradition is to be exhausted, having read too many books and talked to too many students and getting ready for a break. Fred, Paul, anything you would add to this sort of tradition? I'm here with, this is John Mark Reynolds, Fred Sanders and Paul Spears, my colleagues at Tory Honors. Fred, we'll start with you.
Yeah, John Mark, I would just say that Dead Kitty Party, which I bear some of the blame for getting started.
I think you bear 90% of the startup blame.
No. Is the book that it's attached to?
Oh, careful.
Sorry, yeah.
Grenville Kleiser.
But I
Google
can
him.
Say, yeah, you can look up Grenville Kleiser, and I'll just say that John Mark Reynolds is the one who does a performance of a Grenville Kleiser poem utterly terrifying that I have to keep coming back every year to see. It's just unspeakable.
Shatner was 1 year. I channeled William Shatner, but I think I've gone well beyond the Shatner.
Wow.
You're post-Shatnerian in your performance of the Song of the L.
Oh, it is. It is a good moment. Paul, you've managed to dodge the Dead Kitty Party the last few years.
That's because I'm trying to keep up a reputation.
That's right. Well, if you're a professor, I mean, professors in one way, I had a grandfather who was a pipe fitter for Union Carbide. We never work hard. We never do work. But in another way, I haven't been to bed before 2 in the morning, 1 in the morning, and been putting in very long days doing intellectual labor the whole time. My head hurts, and probably you're going to figure that out before the end of the show as we say more and more insane things. Paul, how does it feel to be a professor at this time of year? Is Christmas ruined for you in a sense because you're so tired mentally?
No, I actually think I really enjoyed it. It's actually uplifting. I start to notice that the seasons are changing. Biola does a really cool thing where they put up lights all over on the trees.
Yes. Called Christmas lights, Paul.
Thank you, John.
Biola does a cool thing by putting lights on trees.
Not in the same manner that they're like on Christmas trees.
Oh, I see.
Sorry. I'll be more specific for you. I'm sorry I'm not acting in an exact manner.
I know. I told you I was a jerk today because of all of
but,
this.
So it's getting darker earlier, so the lights come out. It's beautiful. You can walk along the paths at Biola.
That's true.
And it just really does change the season in an exciting and enjoyable way for me. And I start thinking about Christmas. The family's reading Christmas stories. We're reading Dickens, A Christmas Carol. Those kinds of things bring me into the season. And it's more than just, I'm always busy. We're always busy. So the fact is that this actually adds energy to this time of year.
Well, this year, Biola got a great new Christmas gift in President Barry Corey, who I just saw at a chairs meeting yesterday. It was fantastic to see him. Was anybody able to go to the faculty and staff party? I had a student meeting last night where Dr. Corey was and can report back on how that went?
Yeah, I don't know if it's confidential, but he actually sang a version of the Beverly Hillbillies song.
I heard a rumor.
Wrote himself.
Said
yeah.
Something like
he's
that.
He's a risk taker. He's a daring public speaker.
Yeah, I gotta love Barry Corey.
To the Beverly, listen about a story about a man named Jay?
That was it.
Poor mountaineer barely kept his family.
Wow.
To the accompaniment
of a banjo. Okay, that was not an invitation to sing.
Oh, yeah. I see. Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned The Christmas Carol by Dickens, and I think of the film versions, the film adaptations of that classic Christmas book, the most literarily satisfying is, in fact, the one
Mr. Magoo?
No, The Muppets.
Oh, The Muppets.
This is the best gift you ever gave me for Christmas, Fred. We watch it every year,
yeah,
thanks to you.
So do we. It's we don't have many let's watch a movie traditions, but we watch The Muppet Christmas Carol every year because I think the decision of the movie makers on the Muppet Christmas Carol to cast Gonzo the Great as Charles Dickens.
I'm sorry. Just two people, Paul and John Mark, laughing while Fred talks. This must be scintillating show today.
While admittedly a counterintuitive casting decision, what it does is put Charles Dickens in front of you so that Gonzo the Great actually speaks so many lines directly from the text of the Dickens book that you learn more about the actual text. It's more like reading the book than any movie version I know of.
I thought because it doesn't underplay the supernatural either.
Oh, that's
that
right.
In many, and the songs work better than the other musical version, which I think is Scrooge or something like that.
Well,
which,
the songs
terrible
are,
songs.
The songs are brilliant in the Muppet Christmas Carol.
That's
They're
right.
actually devotional. Some of them are extended sung prayers.
Yes.
There's a line in one that I think is very theologically rich. It's a song version of God Bless Us Everyone.
Yeah.
I think a baby frog Muppet sings it. I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, we actually
Baby
get
Frog
to,
Muppet, is
I was
going to
say,
title?
What well, my family Tim, enjoys is finally seeing Kermit and Miss Piggy married.
Yeah.
You know, that's just wonderful. The Miss Piggy triumphs.
Well, they've been living in sin for so long that finally what happened.
Now, they're to the pure, all things are pure, Paul.
Well, and it's bizarre that their children are frogs and pigs. Which is better than some kind of frog pig.
Yeah, that's right. The fig. It would be a fig. A frog pig would be a fig. And talking figs, even Jim Henson wouldn't have gone that far.
Well, Tiny Tim, played by Robin the baby frog Muppet, sings a song, Bless Us All, which has the line
Bless
in it.
Bless us all.
That's something like that, but better. Which has
Much
the line,
better.
We reach for you and we stand tall, and in our hopes and dreams we ask you, bless us all. I mean, it's just a really touching moment. It's profound.
Well, I've had to direct a lot of theater, direct a fair amount of musical theater, and my test for a good musical theater number is it advances the story and tells you something new about the characters you didn't know before. Hmm. It's not just a song to tell you the two characters in love are in love. Boring or useless, unless it's a brilliant song. Sound of Music does it well. Muppet's Christmas Carol does it well.
Yeah, there is, in fact, one song in the Muppet Christmas Carol that only does that. It's where Scrooge's fiance sings The Love Is Gone, and you think the song will never end. You know,
my
actress,
children are always gone during
pretty
that
actress,
song.
Beautiful voice.
Who's the actress?
I don't even know. I leave the room for that song because it doesn't add anything.
It lets you get popcorn while the movie is still playing.
Good.
You don't have to pause the movie. So it's brilliant in that way. Well, it's like the song they added to The Sound of Music where she's leaving the nunnery and I have confidence in confidence alone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Why is that right there and who cares? So that's true. If we're talking about Christmas specials, my two favorites are Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which I think is probably the best thing ever done with that old-style stop-action.
Oh, man, I can't. Every year I have to watch that.
Yeah, that's just – and there's a good lesson there. We determine that Santa is a kind of red-nosed bigot, and he learns the lesson of tolerance over the course of it. I mean – Rudolph's father is really cruel, right? He's born, his nose shines.
Yeah, and he's ashamed of his son.
Well, he puts mud on it immediately. Here, son, let me put some mud on you. You know, there's something to be said for the new style tolerance, and Rudolph shows us what it is. And then I really like Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
And I know, Fred, you've got some like background on that. Charlie Brown Christmas, shown every year, I think on CBS. Almost didn't get made. Is that true? What's up with Charles Schulz and the Charlie Brown Christmas?
That's right. I can't remember all the details, but that was early on when Charles Schulz was kind of working out how much he was going to merchandise the stuff and whether it was going to work.
Right.
But the continuing controversial, I'm just going to read a whole chapter of the Bible, which is, of course, you know what the
right.
what the special itself is built around.
Yes.
This memorization.
And anti-commercialization of Christmas, which kind of weird because Peanuts became overly commercialized later. But
right.
Okay, let's give Charles Schulz credit, is a big theme. And for it to be on commercial television, I think was quite brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a quiet, understated piece. I mean, there are giant gaps between the speaking voices.
Well, and when they put it on, the Coke was the original sponsor. And the CBS executive saw the script and they said, oh, there's no way we can read Luke. It's Luke, right?
Yeah,
it's Luke. And they tried to pull it and Schulz just said, okay, then pull the whole thing. No reading from Luke, no story.
So
no special.
Here's the Jonah Goldbergization of our culture in that we've been talking about Christmas, two philosophers and a theologian, three committed evangelical Christians, traditional Christians from the get-go, and we haven't said a word about Jesus Christ other than in reference to a Charlie Brown Christmas Carol. Fred Sanders, you're our resident theologian. Obviously, we could do the slogans, Jesus is the reason for the season, it's the Christ Mass, whichever direction you want to take it. Are we demonstrating the problem with Christmas, or is this fundamentally a good thing? What should we be thinking?
You know, I think it's good to take time at Christmas to participate in a common culture and say, you know, you may not be a Christian who's living in communion with Jesus Christ, but you can still benefit. There's still overspill and overflow culturally from the goodness of the Christmas season. So that even when people say happy holidays, of course I'm irritated by the aggressive secularization that
right.
has to scrub every vestige of Christian heritage off of all our public monuments. That's irritating. On the other hand, when everyone in my town is happy in December and saying happy holidays, I think, that's fine. You don't have to be here at the center. I wish you would accept Jesus Christ and live a Christian life.
Right.
But it's also just the fact that Christianity is a great fountain of well-being and benefit, and people around it can benefit.
Of jollification. My favorite word in C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. Let's have some jollification, the act of being jolly. Mm-hmm. I think you start with the manger of Bethlehem, and then the overspill produces a St. Nicholas of Myra, who, whatever the truth of his life was such a holy and godly man that people developed legends about him helping the poor, helping three women. Women get a dowry so that they could be married and not go into a life of prostitution, which was the time period. And out of that overspills, I'll just be blunt, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and the St. Nicholas legend, because the kind of tolerance culturally, but not just weak tolerance like in Rudolph, the kind of robust St. Nicholas tolerance produces a culture that can be jolly about Santa and Rudolph and peppermint canes and gingerbread houses.
One of my favorite, one of my children's favorite stories about St. Nicholas is that he actually got into a fight.
Yeah, this is the main way that we commemorate, the main way we handle the Santa Claus issue at my house with
house
a five-year-old
too.
And a seven-year-old. First of all, we talk about playing Santa Claus,
right.
which sort of puts him in this fictive space and allows my kids not to go around demythologizing all the other children's belief in Santa Claus.
Yes.
But also, I'm not teaching them something that's not true.
So, it's the way my parents handled it, and we've handled it.
We can play Santa Claus, and that's fun, and it's clear that it's a game we play.
Yes.
Even if I pretend that Santa put something in their stockings, it's obviously a game.
Yes.
But the other thing is, when we talk about Saint Nicholas, we talk about Santa Claus and say, oh, see, that's based on Saint Nicholas. And then I tell the story, and the kids were just riveted by the story this year, that Nicholas of Myra, again, who knows how much is pious legend,
right.
and the accounts are sketchy.
But I'll say, these pious legends, you get a certain kind of legend because you were a certain kind of guy.
Right.
If you're a crabby person who hates women, who hates children, you don't develop a set of legends where you love them. But go ahead, right. tell us the story.
Yeah,
well, so the story is
story.
That in the year 325, the Council of Nicaea was called to respond to the Arian controversy. There was a Christology out there that was pretty similar to Jehovah's Witnesses theology these days, that Jesus, however great he may have been, whatever sort of super angel from another world he may have been, he wasn't actually God.
Yes.
So this was Arianism. More than 300 bishops from all over the known world got together in the presence of Emperor Constantine and had a discussion about this. And the extreme minority view was the Arian view. And so Arianism was expelled and Orthodox Christianity was enshrined and
Yay.
Confessed carefully. Yeah. Somewhere in the proceedings, one of the bishops called was actually Bishop Nicholas of Myra, the historical kernel of the Santa Claus legend. And at some point, Arius was making a speech defending his horrible view of the non-deity of Jesus Christ, and St. Nicholas got so upset that he crossed the room and slapped Arius in the face.
That's just wonderful. The guy who was so compassionate to women and children couldn't stand the pompous, overbearing Arius, who persecuted madly anybody who disagreed with him whenever he and his followers had power.
Right. So we mainly talk about Santa Claus at my house, Santa Claus as a great defender of Trinitarian orthodoxy.
That's right.
That he was defending
against actually
Arianism.
The sweet guy also knows when it's time to fight. That's the actually discussion we also have. There are certain things worth fighting for.
Oh, yeah. How bad would you have to be for Santa Claus to slap you
that's
in the face.
Yeah,
pretty bad. That's that's worse than coal in your stocking. It's weird. I mean, we're actually doing this show on the day the church historically commemorates St. Nicholas of Myra.
There you go.
And remembers that he's always been associated with December, which is, I think, and the nature of Christ that's part of the incarnation. Why? In comes Diet Coke for us. This is talk about a Christmas spirit. I feel that Diet Coke has just
Christmas
always been part of.
Christmas is never complete unless
there's Diet Coke.
Now your Christmas jollification can begin.
I think we should slurp loudly.
Well, I do think that you were dangerously undernourished today on Diet Coke. You've only had about 4 gallons so
yeah,
far.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, you know, I have to have a vice to quit when the doctor tells me there's something wrong with me. Otherwise, I just die.
You only have one right now?
Yeah, that's exactly
okay.
right. and just so fit and healthy, and everything is good and true.
By the way, the outcome of the St. Nicholas story at the Council of Nicaea is that Constantine, Emperor Constantine, kicked him out. Constantine wasn't
Would
really...
you stop slurping?
Don't talk
in our
that
ear.
Is you.
Look,
I don't even want to
We're
hear
hearing
this.
A story about the Council of Nicaea. You know, Fred is the serious tutor, and we're kind of like the comic relief that goes along with him.
That's stop just why drinking. I'm here. Stop drinking your Diet Coke and listen to my theological story.
Wow, yes, Henry Kissinger has just entered the room.
Yeah, but he's married to Susan. Wait, Henry Kissinger also dates beautiful women. I see. Oh, okay. That's how All you right. did it, Fred.
So Constantine expelled Santa Claus from the Council of Nicaea.
Jolly old Saint Nicholas, punch Arius in the nose.
The other bishops got together, Sorry. Signed a petition saying, please let Santa Claus come back to the Council of Nicaea. And so Constantine
He'll be ever
said,
so good.
That's right. So Constantine did readmit him, and everyone had a happy Christmas.
We love you, Constantine.
There you go.
Yeah. So I can wear my I Heart Constantine t-shirt again.
Well, it is worth pointing out that he was more interested in good order within his imperial church than he was in the actual theological outcome.
Yeah. And it's actually worth saying, I know people listening to this aren't maybe thinking about apologetics close to Christmas, but people like Dan Brown, who wrote The Da Vinci Code, a book that will soon be forgotten, but isn't yet forgotten. I still see it in airports. His claims that Constantine somehow recreated Christian theology just run absolutely contrary to everything we know about Constantine and his interests. He had no interest at all in controlling the theology of the Council of Nicaea.
Good.
And that story kind of demonstrates that. Well, when we think about Christmas, let's just go around the table for a minute and just say, what's God saying to you this year at Christmas? What's he speaking inside your heart? I'll take the prerogative, John Mark Reynolds, of going last. And we'll start with you, Paul Spears.
You know, I'm just so every time I use it as a time to reflect upon what's God done this year for our family, in the ministry that I'm involved in here at Biola. And I'm just so happy that I've had the opportunities that I've had. I'm happy that my family is healthy. Lisa has been now free of cancer that she had the last couple of years, and she's doing really well. And this is a time where I reflect on God's graces and mercy to me, to my family, to the people that I care for.
Paul, we're really thankful for Lisa's health this year.
Yeah,
that was
just
probably the biggest Tory prayer request over the last
couple years, year and a half.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's the gift of Christmas. I know there might be somebody listening who lost a loved one this year. My mother has gone through, you know, experiencing Christmas without her mom the last couple of years for the first time. And you might ask, well, you know, why does the Spears family get good news and why did I get coal in my stocking this Christmas? I'm left trusting in the sovereignty of God, and I'm reminded of what a pretty Calvinist professor of mine once told me, which was, when he who can does not, it must be better so. And the kind of jollification that a believer who has slipped into paradise is experiencing is not something I would take away from them. And so I rejoice with you, Paul, and you know, we weep with those who are weeping this Christmas. But for those who are wondering, you know, why did God give the Spears a good gift and not us? God gave your loved one the best gift of all by bringing him face-to-face or her face-to-face with the Almighty. Fred, what are you thinking about this Christmas?
Well, in addition to the kind of things that Paul talked about, I'm thinking pretty theologically. I think every year about this, but I've just been especially building up to it this year. The idea of the pre-existence of Christ, that the baby born in the manger, this is not the coming into being of the Son of God, but that long before that birth that we see for us and our salvation, there was a birth, a begetting, a generation of the Son from the Father. And that the Son has always been with the Father, has always come forth from the Father by eternal begetting, eternal generation. There was never a time when he was not. And that means that the God has always existed as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
History is wrapped up in Jesus and permeated by Jesus Christ. He always existed. Let me ask you a question. When we talk about the preexistence of Christ, does it mean, you know, my dad was once asked a question, do you believe in the preexistence of Jesus? Is it bad to say, no, I believe in the preexistence of Christ? What's the relationship between Jesus and the Christ?
Well, So one reason you would make that kind of a distinction is Jesus is a name given to this person in history when he takes into union with himself a complete human
nature.
Away
in the manger guy.
Right. Christ, similarly, is really about his role as mediator incarnate. So Christ doesn't quite get you to this view of preexistence. It's okay to use the term that way, but Christ means anointed one, and
I see.
And our Lord was anointed for his role as mediator, as prophet, priest, and king.
So what's a better thing to say about the second person of the Trinity as preexistent, the Word?
You can go to John 1:1 and talk about the Word who was in the beginning, who was with God and was God, because then in John 1:14, when the Word becomes flesh, it enables you to say something like, so if the Word became flesh, that is, without ceasing to be who he was, added to himself a complete human existence, then he must have still been the Word when he was not yet flesh. And so theologically, you can talk about the not yet enfleshed Word, or the Logos Asarkos.
That's really helpful to me, because I often get these terms confused, and as a philosopher, I like to get my terms right.
Yeah, the Bible tends not to use a technical term like logos asarkos. It will say something like Paul in Philippians 2 will say, have this mind in yourself which was also in this person, who being in very nature God, didn't grasp equality with him, but made himself nothing and took on the nature of a servant, being found in human likeness, was obedient even to the point of death. And then has been exalted above every name. What it says, though, is not, have this mind in yourself which was in the Logos Asarkos. It says, have this mind in yourself which was in Christ Jesus.
Sometimes the Bible is so smart and beautiful that it seems almost unfair that we get to be Christians and other people aren't. But then they could choose to be, and I hope they do choose to be this Christmas. Go to church. It's a time a lot of people are thinking about going to church. Go to church and get in. Don't just stand on the outside looking at the beauty that you see. Which reminds me, of John 1:14, my favorite verse in the Bible, the Word became flesh, really human flesh, the thing that Plato couldn't see, however hard he thought, and dwelt among us. He lived here. He experienced our pain. We don't have a God that's far away, but a God that understands our suffering. And we beheld, we saw his glory. Glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father. I've realized this year that any corner we turn is a corner that could lead to paradise. I was reminded of the death of a senior student in one of the first Torrey graduating class who one day in the fall turned a corner in her car, and her next waking moment was with Christ in paradise. She slipped to the other side. This can happen to any one of us at any time. Christ was born. Christ is coming. There is a first advent and there is a second advent. But I think for each one of us, we have to remember that we'll turn a corner and we'll be with Christ, that Christ will come in all of our lives. I know he'll come literally and physically in the air in the second coming. But for all of us, there's a little second coming where we'll see him. Mm-hmm. And this Christmas time, I was reminded of the finality of Christmas, that Christmas is a beginning and an ending, that I will see him face to face, the child of Bethlehem, child no longer, but the one that John saw, who knew him, who loved him, with eyes as flames of fire, whose mouth was a two-edged sword, and whose face shone like the sun. The Christ of Bethlehem is King of the universe. Jesus Christ is Lord this Christmas, to the glory of God the Father Almighty. You know, I want to wish you guys, Paul Spears, Fred Sanders, a Merry Christmas. And we have just a lot of people to be thankful for this year. Let me go around the room and just have you thank the different people that we should thank. Fred Sanders, who comes to mind when you think Middlebrow, Scriptorium Daily? We wouldn't exist if it weren't for...
Well, I mean, our supervisors at Biola, our dean, Todd Pickett.
Hey, Todd.
Jack Schwartz.
Jack Schwartz, who's done a fantastic job this year filling in his – coming out of retirement, really, to fill in his
He's
vice
come out
provost.
Of retirement like four times.
Yeah. So. May Todd and Jack, may they never retire. They do a good job keeping us in check, more or less. They're not responsible for our insanity, but they are responsible for whatever good we do in some ways.
Yeah. The staff in the Torrey office, Jana Peck and Hillary Daughters.
Yes, and goodbye to Hillary, who's heading off to be a vet and maybe eventually do some – humanitarian work all over the world, sub-Saharan Africa, perhaps. They've been fantastic. Hillary in particular, Jana, who runs everything around here. I'd like to thank all the Torrey faculty. Sometimes as the director, I'm kind of the face guy, the figurehead. I started the darn thing. But, you know, the real mentoring and the real student work now is done by just the fantastic 10 or 11 faculty members we have here, counting the part-time people in Torrey. And what a pleasure it is to work with you guys, but also with the entire Torrey faculty and team. Paul, anybody come to mind?
I want to thank Dustin for all the work he's done. The reason we are actually podcasting as we speak.
Dustin sitting here without a microphone, just smiling at us.
Which is how it should be. But
keep not speaking, Dustin. Hooray.
Yeah, and all the alum and the students, and what a joy it is to be working with them, and just to see how they're growing in Christ and how they continue to grow after they graduate, and, you know, and just how, you know, there are these interesting parental-like moments where you just feel so proud of the people and what they do, and you're just so excited about how God is continually using our students for His kingdom.
Well, I think about the 32 students who knew Angie Good before she was an award that we give to students who are interested in missions. The Immortal class, the first class, you know, I talked to Jason Wells on the phone just the other day, who called. Feel free to call Hope and me. We love to hear from you. Merry Christmas to all of you. And to our listeners who are in a broader community, we get emails from you that are encouraging. We get emails from you telling us we're nuts. We get all kinds of emails. But we appreciate you taking the time to download and listen to this. So Hillary, Jana, Todd, Jack, our new president, Barry Corey, the Torrey faculty, Merry Christmas. God bless us as a frog, Tiny Tim. As Charles Dickens put it best, God bless us. God bless us, everyone. This is John Mark Reynolds for Middlebrow, a service of Scriptorium Daily, where this Merry Christmas, in a jollification way, big ideas have undergone the digital martyrdom.